I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. The Ego Boom, Why the World Really Does Revolve Around You, is a terrific new book that's out now looking at how individuality has gotten a bit out of hand, that the power of ego is driving our desires when we buy consumer goods or how we vote or what we decide to watch on television. This book looks at the culture of narcissism that has been cultivated and what this means for this generation and beyond. Steve Mace joins me now. He co-authored this book with Leanne George. He is a senior editor and national business columnist for Maclean's, formerly of the National Post. He has also won awards for his work at Maclean's. The book is published by Key Porter Books and retails for $27.95. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Steve Mace. Good morning, Mr. Mace.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Yourself?
Good, thanks.
So, a Time magazine in, I guess that was 2006,
mm-hmm.
said that the person of the year, usually a political figure or celebrity or any number of sorts of people,
mm-hmm.
Person of the year, and in 2006 it was you.
Yep.
Was that what inspired this book, or?
Actually, we were actually underway on the book when the Time magazine article landed, and it just acted as more confirmation that we were on the right track. We had actually started a few months earlier than that when Leanne, over lunch, mentioned a statistic she'd seen in the Wall Street Journal that North Americans, or Americans at that point actually, were living alone in greater numbers than we ever had before, and that single-person households had, for the first time, become the most common living arrangement in the United States. And that just triggered a broad-ranging conversation that stretched over several days, and before we knew it, we were deep into research on the book.
And it took, what, 3 years or so, two and a half or so years for this book to get together?
That's right. I mean, between our early conversations, our initial research, getting a publisher interested, getting the book written, and then everything that happens after you actually submit a manuscript, altogether it came out to almost 3 years. But it was about a year and a half of research and writing.
So I'm sort of curious in how this book came together. So the two of you work at Maclean's.
Yep.
And just over lunch, this is how it came about. Did it affect your regular job, your day job?
Well, it affected it in the sense that we began seeing the U-cell everywhere. The U-cell is this concept that we talk about in the book, about a shift in marketing messaging from the aspirational to the affirmational, where old advertising used to essentially focus on our inadequacies, telling us that you're not quite smart enough, you're not quite attractive enough, but we have a product that can help you. We noticed that marketing messaging had really shifted in the past 10 years to this affirmational model where marketers are constantly saying to us, you are wonderful, you are perfect and unique, and what you need is a product that can help you broadcast your wonderfulness to the world. Once we kind of tripped across that idea, we began to see it everywhere. So in that sense, it affected our work, but we were lucky enough that once we actually had a book deal, boss here at Maclean's, Ken White, was very, very supportive of us and provided us each with a few months off to concentrate exclusively on the book.
So this U-cell, you said it came about in the last 10 years or so,
mm-hmm.
and these things don't really come about because someone has a good idea. It seems to me that they come about because there's a need for it or there's a desire for it.
Definitely.
Us as society, I mean, we bought into this.
Mm-hmm.
And we still buy into it. I mean, look at we can pick any area of society, politics or burgers.
That's right. Yep.
Do you think that we move towards this because we felt there was a need to affirm ourselves?
I think it's complicated, and there are a lot of different things driving it, but that's certainly part of it. I think the marketing messaging that we talk about in the book is both a reflection and a driver of this trend that we're talking about. But another important thing that we get into in the book that we feel is driving this forward is back around the late 1970s, early 1980s, we saw the rise of institutionalized self-esteem, particularly in our school systems, but really in all sorts of institutions that were aimed at kids. We really internalized this idea that the single most important thing that we could do for children is to bolster their self-confidence. And the worst thing you could possibly do is subject young children to any sort of adversity or failure. And this really became the kind of guiding philosophy for a huge number of our institutions across society, particularly in the realm of education. Now, of course, bolstering self-esteem is a laudable goal. You know, as a parent myself, you know, you really want your kids to feel that that feeling of success. But at some point along the line, self-esteem can trip over this line into narcissism. And when you look at various studies that have been repeated generation by generation over the course of many decades, as you'll see in the book, I think the case becomes very strong that we have at some point tripped across this line into narcissism and gone from healthy self-esteem into pretty toxic self-regard. And that has all kinds of negative consequences for society. But business and marketing has actually done a very good job of kind of drilling into that mindset as it has spread and has managed to turn it into a pretty profitable line of work.
And you draw the line in the book to this current economic crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that that culture of narcissism that we're mired in is perhaps the cause of that?
I think I wouldn't say that it's the cause, but I think it's a very significant factor. And to put it in the simplest terms, I mean, you start to ask yourself, well, what would drive a rational person to take on the kind of debt loads that we've seen in North America over the past 5 years? And we think that the ego boom is a huge part of that. For somebody to go out and take on a $500,000 mortgage when they have no job or an extremely low-paying job, at some point, that is not about the house. You know, that is about projecting a certain image to the world around you. And we see that mindset in all kinds of places. We feel like what has happened in the past 10 years is that on a really vast scale, we've gotten divorced from the idea that consumption is about satisfying needs, and even divorced from the idea that it's about satisfying tangible desires. This is about chasing an intangible desire to express ourselves at every opportunity. And once you have accepted the idea that consumption is about expressing yourself, then you're never really done. That's not an itch that can really be scratched. It becomes a lifelong project of trying to express yourself on ever more insignificant scales. And, you know, I absolutely think that once the banks decided that they were going to throw out their risk models and finance this through absolutely jaw-dropping amounts of debt, then what you had was a perfect storm coming together, our own narcissism with the availability of credit. And the result is what you see in the economy all around you today.
So the seeming lack of credit that we have now because of the so-called crisis, job losses and so on, do you think we'll get away from that culture of narcissism, or are we just stuck in it?
I think that we are going to go into a period now where a lot of this stuff is going to change, but it's not going to go away. Because the culture of narcissism, I mean, the boom that we talk about and the ego boom, that has happened in the past 10 years. But a lot of the underlying mentality that we're talking about has been building for generations. You know, and in fact, the whole idea of, you know, individualism and the rugged individual, that is built into a lot of our myth, our cultural myth in North America. And when you look at the increasing self-regard, the increasing isolationism and individualism, that has been building generation by generation. And it has really exploded in the past 10 years, but it didn't just arrive 10 years ago, if you see what I mean. And as a result, I don't think there's any reason to think that it's going to go away just as quickly, simply because we're in an economic crisis. But it will be interesting to see how, you know, just changing economic reality will shift things, and how the U-cell possibly will be used to push a different set of values.
In the book, you talk about the rise and fall of Monday Night Football on ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And what did that for you? What did that program success and decline? What did that signify for you?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to focus on Monday Night Football is because in the course of writing this, I read an awful lot of stuff about the decline, laments about the decline of Monday Night Football. At the same time as we were reading a lot about the fragmentation of the world of entertainment and culture. And a lot of the people who were studying this were looking at it saying, One of two things: either that, you know, the decline of big brands like Monday Night Football was a real tragedy because we'd lost this area of common ground, or on the other hand, you had people like Chris Anderson in the long tail, for example, who were saying that as consumers gain control over the media that they watch, and you know, we all get PVRs and watch TV what we want when we want, and can download things from the internet, that this is a great thing, that this is going to lead to the democratization of culture and a much more dynamic, responsive culture. But the more I looked at it, the more it struck me that both sides are wrong, that in fact what's happening here is not as significant a change as we might all expect, but it's actually just more of that illusory U-cell being unleashed on us. Because Monday Night Football is still around. Monday Night Football is on ESPN now, and it is just as profitable as it's ever been. And basically what it comes down to is that all this fragmentation that people are talking about have actually increased the power of these big cultural brands, because there are so many different ways to access them now. So Monday Night Football may have moved from ABC to ESPN, and people might think that that is some major shift in the culture, but in fact what's happening is that these big institutions like ABC and Disney are finding new ways to profit from these brands by putting greater control in people's hands. Perhaps a better example might be American Idol. This is a show that, you know, has been incredibly dominant in the ratings in the past few years. But if you look at the actual number of people who tune in and watch it live in terms of ratings, you know, it doesn't compare to the success of the top-rated shows in the 1970s. But when you take into account all the different ways that American Idol is merchandised and sold back to us, it is a far, far more powerful cultural brand than anything that we saw in the 1970s.
As an exercise of comparing and contrast Canada to the United States, you mentioned Monday Night Football, you mentioned American Idol. Those are American examples. How do you think we as Canadians fare? Are we as narcissistic, do you think, or as mired in this as the Americans are, or are we different?
I think we are as mired in it, to be perfectly honest with you. It's a good question, and it comes up a lot. People, you know, have suggested, I was just on a panel with Elizabeth May this week, and Elizabeth suggested that, you know, while she sees the same trends happening here, she feels like, you know, this is truer in the United States than it is up here. I think that that exceptionalism that we Canadians focus on is a bit of a myth. There are certainly differences, but, you know, another big myth that's out there, for example, is that Canadians didn't take on as much debt as Americans did. Well, the deeper we get into this economic crisis, the more apparent it becomes that actually we did. And when you look at comparisons between our income and our debt, for example, we're just as high, if not higher, than the Americans. I think we spend a lot of times patting ourselves on the back and saying, well, we're more community-minded, and it's really Americans that are all individualistic and selfish and narcissistic. But I think that the differences between Canada and the United States, especially on questions of deep culture and mindset, are not as great as some people might think.
Now, you described that Barack Obama, mm-hmm. is the quintessential U-cell candidate.
Yeah.
And it's a very good argument, because it does, he meant a lot to a lot of people, and one person's interpretation of him, or why they liked him, is very different from someone else's.
Absolutely, and I believe that was a key part of his strategy to get elected. Now, some people, when they hear me say this, think that I'm being cynical or that I'm criticizing Barack Obama. I'm really not. I think that he may yet be a great president. But one of the companies we talk about in the book quite a bit is Dell Computer, and one of their top marketing guys said to me, we want to be the blank canvas upon which people project their ideas of what a great product is. And when you look at the key strategies employed by the Obama campaign, I think they did much the same thing. They managed to make Barack Obama the blank canvas upon which people were projecting their ideas of great leadership. And they did that by using some really classic U-cell techniques. They focused on broad themes, fairly vague themes like change and hope. Change and hope, the beauty of them is that they sound good, but they can mean a million things to a million different people. Change literally just means anything other than what we've got. And that was very, very effective, and brought in a huge wide range of people into the Obama camp and was critical to his success getting to the White House. The trick becomes, how do you use those techniques, and can you use those techniques to push forward with a policy agenda? And that's going to be the big question, I think, for the Obama presidency over the next 4 years.
You and Leanne are journalists, and you've written this book, and you've looked at this critically in your columns and your articles in Maclean's. Do you look at all this? Do you look at society today sort of cynically, looking at us, the regular people, I guess, because we're not journalists. Do you look at us that we're perhaps foolish, that we've succumbed to all this?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because the answer is an emphatic no. One of the things that was amazing for us and continues to be amazing for us as we research this book is that we see ourselves in this constantly. Even now, I'll be the first one to admit that the shift toward customized products and the ability to customize various things to your own specifications, especially through the internet, is very, very appealing to me. It works on me constantly. The affirmational messaging in the U-cell is a much more appealing and effective method of reaching me as a consumer than the old aspirational model. And I don't think that it's a matter of cynicism at all. I think one of the things that we wanted to do, the deeper we got into this book, it started in the world of marketing and then spread. We really wanted to talk about a mindset that we saw spreading into various different aspects of our lives. And we felt that there was a certain power in just describing that mindset and describing the tools that that big institutions and big brands were using to reach us. Just by talking about those things, it serves as kind of an inoculation for people, and it allows people to take a look at their motivations for the things that they buy and the things that they support and the ideas that they subscribe to. And we feel like that's a valuable exercise. We don't have a definitive answer on how to fix some of the problems that we've identified here, but we feel like there is value in examining how some of these things came about and why they remain powerful.
In looking at the problem, do you see a solution anytime down the road? Like, did you see us getting away from this culture of narcissism?
Well, what we're not going to do is sit back and argue that everybody should get out and attend more church picnics, if you know what I mean.
Right.
There are certain interesting things that we see happening. One of the things that we talk at near the end of the book, we talk about harnessing the boom and how different nonprofit organizations and charities, for example, are using some of the techniques of the U-cell to encourage people to come back into the fold, to volunteer, to give, and that sort of thing. Various church groups and that sort of thing are finding that they have to change their message in order to make themselves appealing in the era of the ego boom. And that's a very interesting trend for us to watch. I see it in Barack Obama as well, how he is using some of the techniques of the U-cell to now shift his rhetoric slightly and start talking about the value of selflessness, the value of dedicating yourself to a project larger than yourself, if you see what I mean. And the thing that makes us both, I think, fairly optimistic about where this could yet lead is the fact that community still has a good brand, and narcissism is still seen as a failing. Despite the direction that we've all gone, despite the fact that we've become very alienated from a lot of the institutions that formed community and have gotten more and more wrapped up in our own individual bubbles, we still see value in those social connections. And as long as that is the case, I'm optimistic that that this doesn't necessarily need to be a disaster, that there are still things that can be redeemed out of.
Finally, Steve, there was a review in the Globe and Mail the reviewer in his piece pointed out that a problem of this book was that the authors do not explain why the world revolves around you or why it should. Do you want to address that concern that was brought up?
Well, I think the reviewer misinterpreted what we were trying to do. When he said that we don't explain why it should, that's because we don't think that it should. I think even cursory read of the book would tell you that we are not endorsing the idea of increased narcissism. And the reviewer seemed to be under the impression that we were. I'm not sure how he got that impression, but we certainly, I think, spent, well, the first half of the book talking about why the world revolves around you. It revolves around you increasingly because there has been profit in it for the people who wield the U-cell effectively. And the people that have been propagating the idea that consumption is a necessary form of self-expression have done so because there is great profit in it. So I don't really understand the criticism.
Did you enjoy writing this book? I've never written a book, so is it easier writing with someone else?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the process of writing it. The good thing is Leanne and I have been colleagues for a long time now, I guess 5 or 6 years, and so it was a very enjoyable process. We went back and forth, and we had different things that we were focusing on, and wound up writing a lot and passing chapters back and forth for the other person to edit and add things to and make suggestions and that sort of thing. So it turned into a very enjoyable, organic process. It was a lot of work, but it was certainly worth it.
Well, it is a terribly fascinating book. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks very much.
The book is called Ego Boom, Why the World Really Does Revolve Around You. Key Porters, its publisher, $27.95, co-authored with Leanne George, Steve Mache on the line. I'm Joseph Ponto.